influence my decisions as little as possible, and I then believed that I had somehow avoided personal responsibility for the state of the modern world because I was not really responsible for the state of my life, and that I had escaped from the possibility that my plans wouldn't work out because I had no plans. It was on this rock-solid foundation that I looked out at the world and saw around me people who were stupid enough to add their own selves into the equation. To put this kind of faith in oneself, to believe that there exists inside of oneself a motive force, call it an interest, which will respond to life and carry one through uncertainty and adversity, is an irrational attitude without equal. And it is with this irrational approach to life that the conflict of the opposites is resolved, it seems to me. But the problem now is this. In order to have this faith in one's irrational nature, one needs proof that personal interests and passions are capable of sustaining one through the uncertainties and adversities of life that the rational mind foresees so clearly. And the only way to get that proof is to risk oneself and see the result. It is a very exceptional person who can take such an undertaking on their own. Most of us need guidance and support from others, from believers, so to speak. Strange, isn't it, that religious terms should become useful for this discussion? As I wrote that last paragraph, I was suddenly reminded of your idea that the devil, as he is represented in Milton's Paradise Lost, is a metaphor for the rational intellect placed in the position of the highest psychic authority. Better to rule in hell than to serve in heaven. Hell, then, is a condition in which the rational mind, with its acute consciousness of the many perils of life, holds sway over the individual and effectively prevents him from engaging in life, which results in the morally degenerate state of weakness that I described in the first pages of this letter. And heaven, I presume, would be a condition in which the rational mind subordinates itself to faith in God. But what is God? You have a chapter in the manuscript of your book titled The Divinity of Interest. Your ideas are starting to make sense to me now. At least I think they are. Faith in God means faith in that which kindles one's interest and leads one away from the parental sphere out into the world. To deny those interests is to deny God, to fall from heaven and land squarely in hell, where one's passions burn eternally in frustration. What was it God said when he cast Adam out of Eden? Something about working in the dust to the end of his days, with the specter of death always looming in the future. I can certainly relate to that. One of the most vivid impressions I get from recalling all those years I spent moving from one job to the next is the pointlessness of my daily life back then and the glaring knowledge that the end was drawing near. But when I'm doing something that has meaning for me, something that interests me, as I am right now, death seems far away and work seems quite agreeable, even joyous. This theory of the genesis of social psychopathology, this theory of a direct relationship obtaining between personal choice and fascistic or decadent personality and social movement, finds its precise echo in Taoist philosophy and can be more thoroughly comprehended through application of that perspective. The traditional Taoist believes that profane human experience consists of the differentiated parts of an essentially uncategorizable background, the Tao, which may also be interpreted as meaning or as the way. Tao manifests itself as the eternal flux of being. The natural categories of yin and yang, represented in Figure 59, the constituent elements of existence, reprise, constitute the most fundamental divisions of Tao, the basic, maternal and patriarchal constituent elements of experience. Much of ancient Chinese philosophy, cosmology, medicine, political theory, religious thinking, is predicated on the idea that pathology is caused by a relative excess of one primordial substance or the other. The goal of the Chinese sage, physician, spiritual leader, or social administrator, is to establish or re-establish harmony between the fundamental feminine and masculine principles, and to diagnose and cure the faulty action or irresponsible inactions that led to their original discord. The schematic representation of yin and yang, portrayed in Figure 59, utilizes the image of a circle to represent totality. The serpents that make up that circle are opposed but balanced. The image is rendered additionally sophisticated by the presence of the white circle in the black serpent and vice versa. Too much chaos breeds desire for order. Yin may therefore serve as mother to yang. Conversely, too much order breeds the desire for novelty as antidote to stultifying predictability. In this manner, yang serves as father to yin. The fascist, who will not face the reality and necessity of the unknown, hides his vulnerable face in a pathological excess of order. The decadent, who refuses to see that existence is not possible without order, hides his immaturity from himself and others in a pathological excess of chaos. The fascist is willing to sacrifice painful freedom for order, and to pretend that his unredeemed misery is meaningless so that he does not have to do anything for himself. The decadent believes that freedom can be attained without discipline and responsibility because he is ignorant of the terrible nature of the undifferentiated ground of reality and is unwilling to bear the burden of order. When he starts to suffer, as he certainly will, he will not allow the reality of his suffering to prove to him that some things are real, because acceptance of that proof would force him to believe and to act, would force him as well toward painful realization of the counterproductive and wasteful stupidity of his previous position. The fascistic mode of adaptation is, above all, a method for the direct control of the unknown and unpredictable. Modern human beings, like the ancients, identify the stranger implicitly with the dragon of chaos. The stranger acts unpredictably and thinks unpredictable things, things which might have dramatic and unsettling effect if they were allowed full expression. Extreme conservatism allows for restriction of uncertainty, for evasion of the unknown. It performs this function by ensuring that each member of the group acts, imagines, and thinks precisely like every other member, generally, precisely like the leader, a dark parody of the hero. In times of heightened uncertainty, periods of increased unemployment or unsettled political structure, the call for return to the glorious past therefore always arises. The fascist, dominated by his fear, believes that the world should only be order, because disorder is too frightening to consider. This makes the cosmos he creates, when granted the opportunity, a place of endless sterility and machine-like organization. This increased conformity allows at least for the temporary alleviation and restriction of anxiety, but damages the capacity of the group, his group, that is, to respond flexibly to inevitable change. It is as if, to use a biological metaphor, the fascist strives to force all the genetic diversity out of his species. No diversity means no variance in response to new challenges, means one solution, likely the wrong one, to every problem. The suppression of deviance, of the unknown, therefore merely ensures its irrepressible emergence in negative guise at some undetermined point in the future, as problems ignored do not go away, but get worse as they follow their own peculiar developmental path. The order the fascist imposes, therefore, bears within it the seeds of its own destruction. The fascist tends to be cruel as well as rigid and will pursue his cruelty even at the cost of his own stability. The Nazi persecution of the Jews, for example, continued at an increasing rate and with increasingly harsh procedures as it became more and more evidently a burden to the war effort. Nazi hatred therefore became a force so potent as the Third Reich developed that it overcame Nazi patriotism motivated by mortal terror of the unknown. Underneath the fascists' professed patriotism and cowardly love of order is an even more profound phenomenon. Hatred for the tragic conditions of existence and for the vulnerable life that makes those conditions evident. For they reasoned unsoundly, saying to themselves, "Short and sorrowful is our life, and there is no remedy when a man comes to his end, and no one has been known to return from Hades. Because we were born by mere chance, and hereafter we shall be as though we had never been. Because the breath in our nostrils is smoke, and reason is a spark kindled by the beating of our hearts. When it is extinguished, the body will turn to ashes, and the spirit will dissolve like empty air. Our name will be forgotten in time, and no one will remember our works. Our life will pass away like the traces of a cloud, and be scattered like mist that is chased by the rays of the sun and overcome by its heat. For our allotted time is the passing of a shadow, and there is no return from our death because it is sealed up and no one turns back. Come, therefore, let us enjoy the good things that exist and make use of the creation to the full as in youth. Let us take our fill of costly wine and perfumes and let no flower of spring pass by us. Let us crown ourselves with rosebuds before they wither. Let none of us fail to share in our revelry. Everywhere let us leave signs of enjoyment, because this is our portion and this our lot. Let us oppress the righteous poor man. Let us not spare the widow, nor regard the gray hairs of the aged, but let our might be our law of right, for what is weak proves itself to be useless." Wisdom 2:1-11. Fascist cruelty is motivated by the affective consequences of pathologically increased order. When the water of life dries up, nothing is left of existence but its inevitable pains and frustrations, compounded by terrible boredom. Furthermore, anomaly inevitably accumulates as order is imposed in an increasingly strict manner. This adds increased apprehension of chaos to pain, frustration, and stultification. Individuals subjected to a surfeit of such emotions have every reason to be vengeful, aggressive, and cruel, have placed themselves in a state where the emergence of such motivation is certain. The unknown appears only when there has been error. The fascist says, "I know everything there is to know." He cannot, therefore, make an error. But error is the mother of all things. The inability to admit to imperfection, therefore, means withdrawal from every informative situation. This means death of continued adaptation and certain future reemergence of the unknown in negative guise. If you do not change in the face of constant slow transformation, then the discrepancies and unresolved errors pile up and accumulate. The more stubborn, read, arrogant you are, the longer the period of time during which this accretion occurs. Sooner or later, so much unknown surrounds you that it is no longer avoidable. At that point, the dragon of the underworld emerges and swallows you whole. Then you live in the belly of the beast, in darkness, in the night, in the kingdom of the dead. Hatred comes easily in such an environment. The decadent says, "There is no such thing as to know," and never attempts to accomplish anything. Like his authoritarian counterpart, he makes himself immune from error. since mistakes are always made with regard to some valued, fixed, and desired end. The decadent says, look, here is something new, something inexplicable. That is evidence, is it not, that everything that I have been told is wrong? History is unreliable, rules are arbitrary, accomplishment is illusory. Why do anything under such circumstances? But he is living on borrowed time, feeding like a parasite on the uncomprehended body of the past. If he works sufficiently hard and saws off the branch on which he is sitting, then he will fall too into the jaws of the thing he ignored. The habitual act of avoidance, of rejection, weakens the personality in a direct causal manner. The strength of a personality might be defined in part as its breadth of explored territory, its capacity to act appropriately in the greatest number of circumstances. Such strength is evidently dependent upon prior learning, at least upon learning how to act, and knowledge of how to act is generated and renewed as a consequence of constant, voluntary, exploratory behavior. If everything new and different is rejected out of hand, the personality cannot adjust itself to changing circumstances. Circumstances change inevitably, however, as a consequence of simple maturation, as a consequence of entropy itself. It is of little use to be entirely prepared for the past. Furthermore, it is only possible to remain prepared for the future by facing the present. Anomaly is, therefore, spiritual food in the most literal sense. The unknown is the raw material out of which the personality is manufactured in the course of exploratory activity. The act of rejecting anomaly transforms the personality into something starved, something senile, and something increasingly terrified of change, as each failure to face the truth undermines capacity to face truth in the future. The man who comes to adopt an inappropriate attitude toward the unknown severs his connection with the source of all knowledge, undermining his personality, perhaps irreparably. This disillusion of strength is self-perpetuating. Every weakness increases the likelihood of further weakness. For he that hath, to him shall be given, and he that hath not, from him shall be taken even that which he hath. Mark 4:25. The individual who turns away from indications of his own insufficiency increases the probability that he will seek to repress and destroy all information that indicates threat to current belief. Avoided, suppressed, or otherwise undeveloped elements of personality are not accessible for use in conscious adaptation, will in fact offer resistance to such adaptation as a consequence of their resentment at being twisted and ignored. Failure to utilize full human potential severely undermines strength of individual character. Dissociation of action, imagination, and ideation weakens personality. Weakness of personality means inability to bear the weight of the conscious world. The result of the hypocritical suppression of individual differences in the service of the social unit and its intrapsychic representative is frailty in the face of the unknown. And if a house be divided against itself, that house cannot stand. Mark 3:25. The Adversary in Action, a 20th Century Allegory. Jung once said that any internal state of contradiction, unrecognized, will be played out in the world as fate. This statement carries with it the apparent stamp of mysticism. How could the world play out a psychological condition, or the refusal to recognize a psychological condition? Well, the purpose of abstraction is to represent experience and to manipulate the representations to further successful adaptation. If we both want the same toy, We can argue about our respective rights to it. If the argument fails, or if we refuse to engage in it, we can fight. If we are suffering from moral uncertainty at the philosophical level and cannot settle the internal war, then our behavior reflects our inner disquiet, and we act out our contradictions in behavior, much to our general discredit. Thus, the means of settling a dispute cascade with each failure down the chain of abstraction, from the word to the image to the deed. And those who will not let their outdated identities and beliefs die when they must, kill themselves instead. Alexander Solzhenitsyn describes how order and predictability were thereby established in the Soviet Union during Stalin's extensive reign of terror. An eyewitness has told how executions were carried out at Adak, a camp on the Pechora River. They would take the opposition members with their things out of the camp compound on a prisoner transport at night. And outside the compound stood the small house of the third section. The condemned men were taken into a room one at a time, and there the camp guards sprang on them. Their mouths were stuffed with something soft, and their arms were bound with cords behind their backs. Then they were led out into the courtyard, where harnessed carts were waiting. The bound prisoners were piled on the carts from 5 to 7 at a time, and driven off to the Gorka, the camp cemetery. On arrival, they were tipped into big pits that had already been prepared and buried alive. Not out of brutality, no. It had been ascertained that when dragging and lifting them, it was much easier to cope with living people than with corpses. The work went on for many nights at Adak. And that is how the moral political unity of our party was achieved. The invention, establishment, and perfection of the concentration camp, the efficient genocidal machine, might be regarded as the crowning achievement of human technological and cultural endeavor, motivated by resentment and loathing for life. Invented by the English, rendered efficient by the Germans, applied on a massive scale by the Soviets and the Chinese, revivified by the Balkan conflict. Perfection of the factory whose sole product is death has required truly multinational enterprise. Such enterprise constitutes, perhaps, the prime accomplishment of the cooperative bureaucratization of hatred, cowardice, and deceit. Tens of millions of innocent people have been dehumanized, enslaved, and sacrificed in these efficient disassembly lines in the course of the last century to help their oppressors maintain pathological stability and consistency of moral presumption enforced through terror, motivated by adherence to the lie. The very name has an uncanny aspect, horrifying, ironical, allegorical. Camp, that is summer sun and holiday, satirical comedy and masquerade, military rule, obedience and efficiency. Death camp, the very devil's idea of a joke, of camp, black humor and vacation paradise, the dystopian state induced in reality by diligent pursuit of fantastic ideal, ideological purity, statist heaven on earth. Concentration camp. That is a concentration of people in arbitrary association. Restriction of movement and thought to a particular area. Concentration of the processes of human life, distillation, reduction to essence, forcing attention to, concentration on, the central values underlying human endeavor. The concentration camp has spawned its own literature, remembrance of survival under conditions as harsh as imagination can construct. Human imagination, capable, as James Joyce described, of positing the existence and describing the nature of an eternally torturous hell, with walls 7 miles thick, lit by a fire which consumes and renews flesh simultaneously, so that it can once again be burned away. This camp literature has a strange affective and descriptive consistency, a consequence of the constant reemergence of patterned innate modes of adaptive action and thought, arising naturally in response to experience of overwhelming anomaly and extreme threat. Camp life is still human existence, analogous to normal life in all its facets, but made starker, less ambiguous, clarified, laid bare, as Solzhenitsyn states. Pardon me. You love life? You? You? You who exclaim and sing over and over and dance it, too. I love you, life. Oh, I love you, life. Do you? Well, go on. Love it. Camp life. Love that, too. It, too, is life. There where there is no struggle with fate, there you will resurrect your soul. You haven't understood a thing. When you get there, you'll collapse. The extreme nature of camp conditions appears merely to augment tendencies for behavior always present under normal conditions, appears merely to exaggerate the expression of possibilities innately characteristic of the human soul. Camp incarceration, in the typical case, begins with the fall, with arrest, unexpected, unjust, arbitrary, implacable, and terrifying. The prisoner-to-be starts his involuntary descent into the underworld with his historically determined defenses intact, firmly embedded in his cultural context, entrenched in his persona, identified with his job, his social status, his view of the present, his hopes for the future. The initial intrusion of fate into this self-deceptive security occurs at night. Arrest takes place without warning, in the early hours of the morning, when people are easily frightened, dazed, and less likely to offer resistance, more willing to cooperate in their fear and naive hope, afraid for the security of their nervously gathered family, standing helpless in their household at the mercy of state authority in its most contemptible and repressive incarnation. As Solzhenitsyn observes, "That's all there is to it. You are arrested. And you'll find nothing better to respond with than a lamb-like bleat. Me? What for?" That's what arrest is. It's a blinding flash and a blow which shifts the present instantly into the past and the impossible into omnipotent actuality. That's all. And neither for the first hour nor for the first day will you be able to grasp anything else. Except that in your desperation, the fake circus moon will blink at you. It's a mistake. They'll set things right. And everything which is by now comprised in the traditional, even literary image of an arrest will pile up and take shape, not in your own disordered memory, but in what your family and your neighbors in your apartment remember. The sharp nighttime ring or the rude knock at the door. The insolent entrance of the unwiped jackboots of the unsleeping state security operatives. The frightened and cowed civilian witness at their backs. The traditional image of arrest is also trembling hands packing for the victim, a change of underwear, a piece of soap, something to eat. And no one knows what is needed, what is permitted, what clothes are best to wear, and the security agents keep interrupting and hurrying you. You don't need anything. They'll feed you there. It's warm there. It's all lies. They keep hurrying you to frighten you. The kind of night arrest described is, in fact, a favorite, because it has important advantages. Everyone living in the apartment is thrown into a state of terror by the first knock at the door. The arrested person is torn from the warmth of his bed. He is in a daze, half asleep, helpless, and his judgment is befogged. In a night arrest, the state security men have a superiority in numbers. There are many of them armed against one person who hasn't even finished buttoning his trousers. Arrest means instantaneous depersonalization, isolation from family, friends, and social position. This forcibly induced shift of context removes, by design, all concrete reminders of group identity, all hallmarks of social hierarchy, destroys all previous ideals, undermines all goal-directed activity, exposes essential human vulnerability, and subjects it to ruthless exploitation. The arrested individual is brutally stripped of every reminder of previous identity, his predictable environment, his conditional hope, left bereft even of his clothes and hair. He is treated with utmost contempt and derision, regardless of his previous social status. This complete destruction of social context, of social identity, heightens the newly arrested individual's sense of self-consciousness, of nakedness and vulnerability. This leaves him unbearably anxious, tremendously uncertain, miserably subject to a new and uncertain world, or underworld. The existential psychotherapist Viktor Frankl describes his experiences in the concentration camp. We waited in a shed, which seemed to be the anteroom to the disinfecting chamber. SS men appeared and spread out blankets into which we had to throw all our possessions, all our watches and jewelry. There were still naive prisoners among us who asked, to the amusement of the more seasoned ones who were there as helpers, if they could not keep a wedding ring, a medal, or a good luck piece. No one could yet grasp the fact that everything would be taken away. I tried to take one of the old prisoners into my confidence. Approaching him furtively, I pointed to the roll of paper in the inner pocket of my coat and said, "Look, this is the manuscript of a scientific book. I know what you will say, that I should be glad to escape with my life, that that should be all I can expect of fate. But I cannot help myself. I must keep this manuscript at all costs. It contains my life's work. Do you understand that?" Yes, he was beginning to understand. A grin spread slowly over his face, first piteous, then more amused, mocking, insulting, until he bellowed one word at me in answer to my question, a word that was ever present in the vocabulary of the camp inmates. "Shit." At that moment, I saw the plain truth, and did what marked the culminating point of the first phase of my psychological reaction. I struck out the whole of my former life. The arrested individual has no specific socio-historically determined intrapsychic structure to protect himself from the terrible world of incarceration and slavery, no model of desire and expectation to inhibit his mortal terror, to guide his activity and to channel his hope. He has been forcibly ejected from paradise, made intolerably aware of his own essential limitations, his own nakedness, has been sentenced to endless labor and subjugation. In consequence, he has been rendered vulnerable to his worst fears, his most chaotic psychological states, and his most severe depressions, as Solzhenitsyn notes. Here is how it was with many others, not just with me. Our initial first prison sky consisted of black swirling storm clouds and black pillars of volcanic eruptions. This was the heaven of Pompeii, the heaven of the Day of Judgment. Because it was not just anyone who had been arrested, but I, the center of this world. Our last prison sky was infinitely high, infinitely clear, even paler than sky blue. We all, except religious believers, began from one point. We tried to tear our hair from our head, but our hair had been clipped close. How could we? How could we not have seen those who informed against us? How could we not have seen our enemies and how we hated them? How could we avenge ourselves on them? And what recklessness, what blindness, how many errors? How can they be corrected? They must be corrected all the more swiftly. We must write. We must speak out. We must communicate. But there is nothing we can do. And nothing is going to save us. at the appropriate time, we will sign Form 206. At the appropriate time, the tribunal will read us our sentence in our presence, or we will learn it in absentia from the OSO. Then there begins the period of transit prisons. Interspersed with our thoughts about our future camp, we now love to recall our past. How well we used to live, even if we lived badly. But how many unused opportunities there were, how many flowers we left uncrumpled. When will we now make up for it? If I only managed to survive. Oh, how differently, how wisely I am going to live. The day of our future release? It shines like a rising sun. And the conclusion is, survive to reach it, survive at any price. This is simply a turn of phrase, a sort of habit of speech, at any price. But then the words swell up with their full meaning and an awesome vow takes shape, to survive at any price. And whoever takes that vow, whoever does not blink before its crimson burst, allows his own misfortune to overshadow both the entire common misfortune and the whole world. This is the great fork of camp life. From this point, the roads go to the right and to the left. One of them will rise and the other will descend. If you go to the right, you lose your life. And if you go to the left, you lose your conscience. Work at a killing pace characterizes concentration camp life. Work under conditions made deathly harsh for the sake of the sheer aesthetic quality of the misery. Senseless labor, mere parody of productive work, accompanied by constant, consciously arranged privation. As Frankl notes, the most ghastly moment of the 24 hours of camp life was the awakening, when at a still nocturnal hour, the three shrill blows of a whistle tore us pitilessly from our exhausted sleep and from the longings in our dreams. We then began the tussle with our wet shoes, into which we could scarcely force our feet, which were sore and swollen with edema. And there were the usual moans and groans about petty troubles, such as the snapping of wires which replaced shoelaces. One morning I heard someone whom I knew to be brave and dignified cry like a child, because he finally had to go to the snowy marching grounds in his bare feet, as his shoes were too shrunken for him to wear. In those ghastly moments, I found a little bit of comfort, a small piece of bread which I drew out of my pocket and munched with absorbed delight. Solzhenitsyn recalls similarly. In cold lower than 60 degrees below zero, workdays were written off. In other words, on such days the records showed that the workers had not gone out to work. But they chased them out anyway, and whatever they squeezed out of them on those days was added to the other days, thereby raising the percentages. And the servile medical section wrote off those who froze to death on such cold days on some other basis. And the ones who were left, who could no longer walk and were straining every sinew to crawl along on all fours on the way back to camp, the convoy simply shot so that they wouldn't escape before they could come back to get them. No one can immerse himself in description of the consciously perpetrated horrors of the 20th century without recognizing, first, that such evil was perpetrated in large part by the well-socialized and obedient. No one can come to such recognition, which is self-comprehension as well, and remain unimpressed by the power and profundity of literary and mythic representations of the power of evil, that living force, that eternally active, transcendent personality, intrapsychically incarnate. That permanent aspect of man, every man, dedicated solely, vengefully to destruction, dissolution, suffering, and death. O Rose, thou art sick. The invisible worm that flies in the night in the howling storm hath found out thy bed of crimson joy, and his dark secret love does thy life destroy. William Blake. The Rwandan massacres, the killing fields in Cambodia, the tens of millions dead, by Solzhenitsyn's estimate, as a consequence of internal repression in the Soviet Union, the untold legions butchered during China's Cultural Revolution, the Great Leap Forward, another black joke, accompanied upon occasion in the particular by devouring of the victim. The planned humiliation and rape of hundreds of Muslim women in Yugoslavia, the Holocaust of the Nazis, the carnage perpetrated by the Japanese in mainland China. Such events are not attributable to human kinship with the animal, the innocent animal, or even by the desire to protect territory, interpersonal and intrapsychic, but by a deep-rooted spiritual sickness endemic to mankind, the consequence of unbearable self-consciousness, apprehension of destiny in suffering and limitation, and pathological refusal to face the consequences thereof. Man is not merely innately aggressive, a poorly socialized and therefore uncontrolled predator. At best, such theory can account for his criminal aggression. It is, in fact, slavish adherence to the forces of socialization, to the very principle of domestication itself, that enables him to participate in production of the most truly efficient and organized of human evils. It was the discipline of the Germans, not their criminality, that made the Nazis fearsome. It was the loyalty, patriotism, and commitment of the Soviet and Chinese communists that enabled the mass persecution and destructive labor camp elimination of their countrymen. Neither is man a victim of society, innocent lamb perverted by social forces beyond individual control. Man created society in his own image. It enables him as much as it corrupts him. Man chooses evil for the sake of the evil. Man exults in agony, delights in pain, worships destruction and pathology. Man can torture his brother and dance on his grave. Man despises life, his own weak life, and the vulnerability of others, and constantly works to lay waste, to undermine, to destroy, to torment, to abuse, and devour. Solzhenitsyn continues, "From the side, we looked like two reddish stones in the field. Somewhere young men of our age were studying at the Sorbonne or at Oxford, playing tennis during their ample hours of relaxation, arguing about the problems of the world in student cafes. They were already being published and were exhibiting their paintings. They were twisting and turning to find ways of distorting the insufficiently original world around them in some new way. They railed against the classics for exhausting all the subjects and themes. They railed at their own governments and their own reactionaries who did not want to comprehend and adopt the advanced experience of the Soviet Union. They recorded interviews through the microphones of radio reporters, listening all the time to their own voices and coquettishly elucidating what they wished to say in their last or their first book. They judged everything in the world with self-assurance, but particularly the prosperity and justice of our country. Only at some point in their old age, in the course of compiling encyclopedias, would they notice with astonishment that they could not find any worthy Russian names for our letters, for all the letters of our alphabet. The rain drummed on the back of our heads, and the chill crept up our wet backs. We looked about us. The half-loaded cars had been overturned. Everyone had left. There was no one in the entire clay pit, nor in the entire field beyond the compound. Out in the gray curtain of rain lay the hidden village, and even the roosters had hidden in a dry place. We, too, picked up our spades, so that no one would steal them. They were registered in our names. And dragging them behind us like heavy wheelbarrows, we went around Matronina's plant, beneath the shed where the empty galleries wound all around the Hoffman kilns that fired the bricks. There were drafts here, and it was cold, but it was also dry. We pushed ourselves down into the dust beneath the brick archway and sat there. Not far away from us, a big heap of coal was piled. Two Zeks, Russian camp inmates, were digging into it, eagerly seeking something there. When they found it, they tried it in their teeth, then put it in their sack. Then they sat themselves down and each ate a similar black-gray lump. "What are you eating there, fellows?" "It's sea clay. The doctor doesn't forbid it. It doesn't do any good, but it doesn't do any harm either. And if you add a kilo of it a day to your rations, it's as if you had really eaten. Go on, look for some. There's a lot of it among the coal." And so it was that right up to nightfall, the clay pit did not fulfill its work norms. Matronina gave orders that we should be left out all night. But the electricity went out everywhere, and the work compound had no lights, so they called everyone into the gatehouse. They ordered us to link arms, and with a beefed-up convoy, to the barking of dogs and curses, they took us to the camp compound. Everything was black. We moved along without seeing where it was wet and where the earth was firm, kneading it all up in succession, losing our footing and jerking one another. And in the camp compound, it was dark. Only a hellish glow came from beneath the burners for individual cooking. And in the mess hall, two kerosene lamps burned next to the serving window. And you could not read the slogan, nor see the double portion of nettle gruel in the bowl, and you sucked it down with your lips by feel. And tomorrow would be the same, and every day. 6 cars of red clay, 3 scoops of black gruel. In prison, too, we seemed to have grown weak, but here it went much faster. There was already a ringing in the head, that pleasant weakness in which it is easier to give in than to fight back, kept coming closer. And in the barracks, total darkness. We lay there dressed in everything wet, on everything bare, and it seemed it was warmer not to take anything off, like a poultice. Open eyes looked at the black ceiling, at the black heavens. Good Lord, good Lord, beneath the shells and the bombs, I begged you to preserve my life. And now I beg you, please send me death. It is reassuring to presume that the individuals who constructed, organized, and ran the concentration camps of Germany and the Soviet Union were in some profound manner different from the people that we know and love and are. But there is no reason to make this presumption except for convenience and naive peace of mind. The image of the concentration camp guard, much as the inmate, defines the modern individual. Hell is a bottomless pit. And why? Because nothing is ever so bad that we cannot make it worse. Solzhenitsyn continues. Fire, fire. The branches crackle, and the night wind of late autumn blows the flame of the bonfire back and forth. The compound is dark. I am alone at the bonfire, and I can bring it still some more carpenter's shavings. The compound here is a privileged one, so privileged that it is almost as if I were out in freedom. This is an island of paradise. This is the Marfino Sharashka, a scientific institute staffed with prisoners in its most privileged period. No one is overseeing me, calling me to a cell, chasing me away from the bonfire. I am wrapped in a padded jacket. And even then it is chilly in the penetrating wind. But she, who has already been standing in the wind for hours, her arms straight down, her head drooping, weeping, then growing numb and still. And then again she begs piteously, "Citizen Chief, forgive me. Please forgive me. I won't do it again." The wind carries her moan to me, just as if she were moaning next to my ear. The citizen chief at the gatehouse fires up his stove and does not answer. This was the gatehouse of the camp next door to us, from which workers came into our compound to lay water pipes and to repair the old ramshackle seminary building. Across from me, beyond the artfully intertwined, many-stranded barbed wire barricade, and 2 steps away from the gatehouse, beneath a bright lantern, stood the punished girl, head hanging, the wind tugging at her gray work skirt, her feet growing numb from the cold, a thin scarf over her head. It had been warm during the day when they had been digging a ditch on our territory. And another girl, slipping down into a ravine, had crawled her way to the Vladikino Highway and escaped. The guard had bungled, and Moscow City buses ran right along the highway. When they caught on, it was too late to catch her. They raised the alarm. A mean, dark major arrived and shouted that if they failed to catch the girl, the entire camp would be deprived of visits and parcels for a whole month because of her escape. And the women brigadiers went into a rage, and they were all shouting, one of them in particular, who kept viciously rolling her eyes. "Oh, I hope they catch her, the bitch. I hope they take scissors and clip, 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 take off all her hair in front of the lineup." This wasn't something she had thought up herself. This was the way they punished women in the gulag. But the girl, who was now standing outside the gatehouse in the cold, had sighed and said instead, "At least she can have a good time out in freedom for all of us." The jailer overheard what she said, and now she was being punished. Everyone else had been taken off to the camp, but she had been set outside there to stand at attention in front of the gatehouse. This had been at 6 p.m., and it was now 11 p.m. She tried to shift from one foot to another, but the guard stuck out his head and shouted, "Stand at attention, whore, or else it will be worse for you." And now she was not moving, only weeping. "Forgive me, citizen chief. Let me into the camp. I won't do it any more." But even in the camp, no one was about to say to her, "All right, idiot, come on in." The reason they were keeping her out there so long was that the next day was Sunday, and she would not be needed for work. Such a straw-blonde, naive, uneducated slip of a girl. She had been imprisoned for some spool of thread. "What a dangerous thought you expressed there, little sister. They want to teach you a lesson for the rest of your life." Fire. Fire. We fought the war, and we looked into the bonfires to see what kind of victory it would be. The wind wafted a glowing husk from the bonfire. "To that flame in you, girl, I promise. The whole wide world will read about you." Who would admit, even to himself, given the choice, "I would be the citizen chief in preference to the punished girl"? And without this admission, there is no reason to change and no reason to combat the evil within. For whence but from the author of all ill could spring so deep a malice, to confound the race of mankind in one root, and earth with hell to mingle and involve, done all to spite the great Creator. Milton, Paradise Lost. faced with the horror of camp life, it too is life. Many become corrupted, as Solzhenitsyn notes. Let us admit the truth. At that great fork in the camp road, at that great divider of souls, it was not the majority of the prisoners that turned to the right. This corruption was not caused by camp conditions, appalling as they were. Bread is not issued in equal pieces, but thrown onto a pile. Go grab. Knock down your neighbors and tear it out of their hands. The quantity of bread issued is such that one or two people have to die for each that survives. The bread is hung up on a pine tree. Go fell it. The bread is deposited in a coal mine. Go down and mine it. Can you think about your own grief, about the past and the future, about humanity and God? Your mind is absorbed in vain calculations which for the present moment cut you off from the heavens, and tomorrow are worth nothing. You hate labor. It is your principal enemy. You hate your companions, rivals in life and death. You are reduced to a frazzle by intense envy and alarm, lest somewhere behind your back others are right now dividing up that bread which could be yours, that somewhere on the other side of the wall a tiny potato is being ladled out of the pot, which could have ended up in your own bowl. Solzhenitsyn, The Gulag Archipelago. Such conditions merely provided the precondition for the emergence of the consequences of decisions already taken prior to incarceration in the large part. Decisions to choose security instead of maintenance of conscience, to embrace safety instead of soul. In looking at the people, we might see that in the space twixt birth and death, one-third follow life and one-third death. And those who merely pass from birth to death are also one-third of those we see. Lao Tzu, The Tao Te Ching. Greed and fear in the everyday world culminate in the same blind inability Solzhenitsyn recognized in the camps, the same incapacity to think about grief, about the past and future, about man and God, but with far less evident justification. Fear of mortality in normal life is most generally dealt with in the same manner as in the camp situation, through absolute identification with the system and consequent rejection of the self, through acceptance of ideological promise, offer of material security, and guarantee of unearned intrapsychic stability. Solzhenitsyn comments, "My friend Panin and I are lying on the middle shelf of a stolypin compartment and have set ourselves up comfortably, tucked our salt herring in our pockets so we don't need water and can go to sleep. But at some station or other, they shove into our compartment a Marxist scholar. We can even tell this from his goatee and spectacles. He doesn't hide the fact. He is a former professor of the Communist Academy. We hang head down in the square cutout, and from his very first words, we see that he is impenetrable. But we have been serving time for a long while, and have a long time left to serve, and we value a merry joke. We must climb down to have a bit of fun. There is ample space left in the compartment, and so we exchange places with someone and crowd in. Hello? Hello? You're not too crowded? No. It's all right. Have you been in the jug a long time? Long enough. Are you past the halfway mark? Just. Look over there, how poverty-stricken our villages are. Straw, thatch, crooked huts. An inheritance from the Tsarist regime. Well, but we've already had 30 Soviet years. That's an insignificant period historically. It's terrible that the collective farmers are starving. But have you looked in all their ovens? Just ask any collective farmer in our compartment. Everyone in jail is embittered and prejudiced. But I've seen collective farms myself. That means they were uncharacteristic. The goatee had never been in any of them. That way,